This is The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. And if one more person makes a Carrick's at the wheel comment, I will confiscate all the wheels. A 2-0 win for Villarreal. According to some, a perfectly executed victory. According to others, like every other Manchester United game this Champions League, play badly, Ronaldo scores, get a result. Elsewhere, the Chelsea juggernaut continues. Reece James, a pure kicker of footballs. Xavi's first Champions League game is goalless. Orange ball alert in Kiev. Another Atalanta game with lots of goals at both ends. And Group G, the group that time forgot, crescendos towards an exciting ending. Elsewhere, we'll do a bit of Serie A, Gareth Southgate's new contract, all that, plus your questions. And that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Barry Glendenning, welcome.
Hello, Max. How are you?
I'm all right. Lars Sivertsen, hello.
Hi, Max. I'm feeling fantastic. It's a great morning.
Nikki Bandini, hello.
Hi, Max.
Hello, Nikki. And joining us for a cameo, Sid Lowe, hello.
Good morning.
I mean, I conned you into cameo, Sid, since pretty much every group has a Spanish football team in it. You're here for quite a while, but I hadn't told you until now.
This is where I throw in my Michael Carrick's at the wheel jokes, that you kick me out and I get to leave at around about the agreed time.
Okay, anyway, Villarreal 0, Manchester United 2. Stu says that was Manchester United's first win under an English manager since the 18th of October 1986. I presume that was Ron Atkinson against Luton Town. How long before their next win under an English manager? Dermot says, if Carrick is not at the wheel, is he at least in control of the stereo or maybe the air conditioning? Carrick said after the game, I've enjoyed the whole thing. It's not been an easy couple of days, but it feels like the result is for Ole. Just let the man move on, for goodness sake. Sid, you were there. How was it?
Well, to be honest with you, not very good, I didn't think, until the last 20 minutes. The one thing that probably Carrick can take some pride in is that I thought that his changes changed the game. The introduction of Rashford and Fernandes. But then, of course, the argument then would be, well, why not start with these guys? It doesn't always work like that, of course. And I was struck, actually, I hadn't heard that particular quote that you've just given us from Carrick, saying, you know, this is for Ole. He said after the game that Ole had been the first person he called when he was asked to take over to see how Ole felt about it, because he thought it was the right thing to do. But also the Man United fans, I don't know if any of you have been to Villarreal, but Villarreal's away end is kind of like a glass box stuck on the top of one of the stands. And it really does look like it's kind of precariously been perched there. Anyway, the United fans in that glass box were chanting Ole's name at the end of the game. So certainly the gratitude is still there for everything that I guess that he was as a player rather than as a manager. But now I would largely go with your initial thought, which was this felt kind of familiar, pretty much like we'd seen this a few times before.
Yeah, I thought, Barry, United were pretty flat for 60-70 minutes.
Yeah, they were outplayed. David De Gea had to make some excellent saves. Well, very good saves. One of them was excellent. I'd be curious to hear, after I finish pontificating or at some point, what does this say about Villarreal, that twice they were on top of a very poor Man United side and weren't able to put them away either time, lost one game, drew the other. But It was a poor game. Villarreal once again played through them. United were a little bit lucky. The silly pass from Trulli to Etienne Capoue, that was just lunacy. Fred intercepted and Ronaldo, bit of genius. Well, he's a genius, I suppose it is, to put United ahead. And I think if Ole was in charge of United and they put in that performance, we'd be giving him another lambasting and saying he was a bit naive. But because he wasn't last night, I did notice on BT Sport, if you hadn't seen the game and were only watching the post-match analysis, it was three former Manchester United players, Paul Scholes, Rio Ferdinand and Owen Hargreaves, you would think United had been unbelievably good and had wiped the floor with Villarreal, and that just wasn't the case at all.
Sid, do you want to answer the Villarreal question?
Well, yeah, just the thing that Barry says about the pass from Rulli to Capoue, that was something that that Unai Emery picked up on after the game. And he said, look, we gave them that goal, but he did say, the game had already changed at that point. It wasn't just about that goal. It's not that that goal changes the game. He says you already got the change when Carrick makes the two substitutions and the impact in particular of Bruno Fernandes he talked about, which obviously is a kind of almost an excuse. It's kind of a way of saying, look how good their squad is compared to ours and look what they can bring onto the pitch. But the other thing about the pass that he made, the point was, he said, look, we know that the way that we want to play brings this risk. So although we got this wrong, we would continue to play this kind of pass. And that was and that tallies with the other thing that Barry was saying that I thought was really, really striking, and said something about, I don't know if it said a lot about Villarreal, said a lot about Manchester United, certainly. In the first half, the amount of times that Villarreal would bring the ball out from the back, but they would genuinely be standing there waiting, going, come on then, come and get it. And United would stand there looking at them. And sort of eventually someone would go, oh, all right then, and sort of trot towards them. And then, of course, Villarreal go, oh, thanks very much, and just pass straight through them again. And it was really striking to me, as someone who doesn't watch Man United all the time, who was doing the match report last night and sort of talking to colleagues and sort of saying, you know, help guide me on United. And after about 20, 25 minutes of Villarreal doing this, saying, come on then, and United go, oh, stepping forward, Villarreal just playing through them, loads of space. It all felt quite slow motion to me. It all felt really kind of easy. And obviously the obvious question at that point was to talk to colleagues, had Jonathan Lewis sitting next to me, and sort of say, are United always like this? Because I was really, really struck with it. And then of course the answer from most of them was, yeah, pretty much. Actually, this is slightly better than they've been for a lot of the season.
And actually, interesting, you mentioned Johnny Lou and Nicky. Johnny's written the Jonathan Wilson, Ronaldo's not the answer piece in today's paper. And, you know, I know we've had this conversation before, and I just wonder, you know, watching that game and knowing how he was at Juve as well, you know, can we keep saying he's not the answer when he keeps getting them out of jail? It feels ridiculous, but I still sort of believe it.
Right, it depends what the question is, doesn't it? I mean, look, the goal was brilliantly taken, and without that Ronaldo intervention, I think this game, I don't know, everyone, I'm sure, has a different perspective. I think the game ends 0-0 if Ronaldo doesn't do a Ronaldo, basically. And yes, that's something that... for sure, when in an evening when Juventus got walloped, and afterwards Allegri's being asked about Ronaldo, and he's saying he's a goal scorer. That's basically what he sort of boiled him down to. And it turns out those are quite useful to have, and certainly in big Champions League ties. I think it doesn't... it's kind of the same as this conversation about whether or not it makes a difference that it's Ole Gunnar Solskjaer or Michael Carrick presiding over this sort of performance. I don't think we learned anything new from it. Ronaldo is and has been for a very long time one of the very, very best goal scorers on the planet. And I think it's definitely... I feel like watching him this season, he's got a little bit of I don't know what the right word is, a little bit of vim back in his game, a little bit of something that had been lost in that last season at Juventus. I do think in that last season at Juventus, he looked like a player who was a bit beaten down by the paucity of everything around him. And I do think that actually, you know, that's a conversation for the Juventus section probably, but he is what he is. And it's very repetitive to say it. He's a very, very good goal scorer who's not going to press for you, who's not going to selflessly work himself into defensive positions all the time for you as an attacker. But if you just want someone to win games from you, he's going to do it quite often.
At last, we should congratulate the other goal scorer, Jadon Sancho. And I think everybody on earth is delighted for Jadon Sancho.
Yeah, it's just nice to see him happy again. It's clearly not worked out that well so far. I mean, I think it's quite obvious that he was signed at a time when United did not think they were going to sign Cristiano Ronaldo. And I mean, I think Merson has taken some stick for this, but I think what Merson said about it was entirely accurate. I mean, I suspect that Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's plan going into the season was to have Sancho on one side, Rashford on the other, and then Cavani for as many games as he physically can, and Greenwood for when he can't up front. And I think that's a front three that makes total sense. When you dropped Cristiano Ronaldo into it, then suddenly it becomes a little bit complicated.
Sorry, I shouldn't have been laughing there. Sorry, I could just see Lars's dog's tail just wagging at the bottom of the screen.
When Lars is making... Lars's dog, the tail wags depending on how much the dog agrees with Lars on the point he's making. And, you know, the dog also loves Jadon Sancho.
Which she's now lined up by the side door to the back garden and given me a very stern look, which I think it means, you know, let me out. I cannot hear this Sancho-based patter anymore. I got to get out of here.
And in a bid to outdo Lars's dog, Nicky's dog is now licking itself on the sofa in the background. It's pornographic.
But I do think it was a good game for Sancho. I mean, United were not good, but I think it was one of the more promising performances overall, not just with the goal. I think he had a couple of runs, and he just looked more comfortable in the shirt than he has earlier in the season. So hopefully this is the start of him showing what he can do, because he can do a lot.
Can we do interim chat, which involves Ernesto Valverde? Jamie Jackson reporting in The Guardian that Manchester United have spoken to him. Is this a good idea, Sid? Would he be happy to be an interim? Would he be good in the Premier League, etc.?
He would be happy to be the interim manager of Manchester United. If United are talking to him, it's because he's willing for them to talk to him. As we understand it, he's definitely...
He's not running away.
He's not like, Ed, no, just leave me alone!
No! I just want to take photos.
I actually do quite like the idea of Manchester United's managerial chase to literally be a chase, a whole load of managers kind of running up the road with Ed puffing behind them. No, come back, people have heard of you. But anyway, he's obviously not the only person they're talking to. This is the thing that obviously when you go into a position like this, and I'm pretty sure this is Valverde's point of view, and I imagine it would be the point of view of the other coaches talking to them. You go in because you accept that it's an interim position, but of course with the hope that things might go well enough that it no longer is an interim position. Valverde, from that point of view, and this is where the sort of the balance is first of all, what he did at Barcelona, I think with time people maybe appreciate again. The managers before him didn't win anything. The managers after him didn't win anything. As soon as he left, all of those crises that he kept a lid on all sort of burst into the open. He manages players very, very well. Broadly speaking, he's very pragmatic. I think he likes 4-4-2, so I would expect United to go into that role, but he's very definitely conditioned by his players and very sensible about that. I think he's someone who will take some of the, if you like, kind of take some of the sense of collapse, I guess, out of it and just kind of get people going again. The question always with these things is how easy is it to do some of those things that are about charisma and control and sort of environment when you're in a different language. But of course, this is a manager who was hugely successful in Greece, where the day-to-day managerial language was English rather than Spanish or Greek. So I think we know that he's done that. He handles the pressure very, very well. The fact that he's at a big club doesn't bother him at all, I don't think. And that's not to say it doesn't bother him, because, you know, if you talk to him, he'll talk about how hard that can be, but he doesn't express it outwardly. He has no ego about himself at all. And I think in that sense, if you're looking at someone for now, he seems to me to be a brilliant fit, yeah.
Meanwhile, Mauricio Pochettino, in long-term manager news, he says he's so happy at Paris Saint-Germain and will not be distracted by reports he's open to taking over at Manchester United. The rumours are there, but this kind of thing cannot distract me, he said. I am so happy at PSG. I am so focused. I love the club. I love the fans. It's a fantastic time to be at the club. My contract is to 2023. This season and one more. I am really happy at Paris Saint-Germain. That is a fact. So he seems to say he's happy.
He doesn't convince at all, does he? I mean, genuinely, yesterday he didn't convince in the slightest. And this argument that I won't be distracted by it, great, that's fine. That's a response for right now. You know, we're preparing for this game right now. That's not the same as saying, I'm not going there.
There was an extraordinary line that I have to admit I've taken this third hand because I heard them talking about it on ESPN. But extraordinary line he apparently said about, well, I know that everyone's going to be picking through my past. And when I was at Espanyol, I said I really admired Sir Alex Ferguson. I hope nobody takes that to mean that I want to go to Manchester United. You think, nobody's brought this up, Mauricio.
that's brilliant. What a genius.
Elsewhere in this group, Young Boys 3, Atalanta 3. Brilliant game. Young Boys thought they'd won it. Hefty, with a hefty strike into the top corner before Muriel came off the bench to score that free kick with his first touch. Nicky, it was sort of very Atalanta-y, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was interesting watching this game and actually listening to what Sid said about perhaps Villarreal missing their chances against Manchester United. And I was thinking, well, didn't Villarreal also miss, you know, 2-1 up against Atalanta at home? They managed not to win. I wonder how much of a sense there is of a a missed opportunity for them in the group. And I think that Atalanta have been Atalanta all the way through this group. Last night, I was at the beginning more concentrated in the sort of dual screen way that we end up watching games if we're not at them at the moment, on the Juventus-Chelsea game or Chelsea-Juventus game, and that ended up being quite boring by the end, I felt like. I mean, it was, I'm sure, good for Chelsea fans, but it was clearly going one way, whereas the Atalanta game was just bonkers. They looked completely in control of the game, 2-1 up. Should have had a penalty, I thought, at 2-1. They had, I'm trying to think what the name of the defender was, but it looked like a foul in the box. Referee waved it away. And then they just basically threw it away. These two goals from Sierra and Hefty in the space of 5 minutes. Luis Muriel comes off the bench and does what Luis Muriel does coming off the bench, which is score a brilliant goal. And they are impossible to predict a lot of the time, other than that they are going to be a bit chaotic in these European games. But yeah, it was great fun. It was great, great fun. A lot of those goals last night were brilliant. I thought Zabata's first goal was brilliant. Palomino scored a goal that was brilliant. I thought Muriel's goal was brilliant. A Hefty strike was sensational, and also had that real vibe as well with young boys who kind of were out the group before that, and suddenly you had this whole stadium rocking and you sort of felt the fences shaking around the pitch. It was a really fun game of football with lots of terrible defending in it.
Let's go to Group E. Bayern top. Through, won all their games. We'll get onto their win in a second. But at the Nou Camp, Barcelona 0, Benfica 0. Stamper says, how will Xabi plan to stop West Ham in the Europa League final? Barca play Bayern Munich in their last group game on the 8th of December. Not guaranteed to go through. They need a win to be absolutely sure of going through. Sid, thoughts on Xabi's start at Barcelona and the appointment overall?
Well, look, the appointment overall, I think... has the ingredients to be the right one in terms of there's a clarity. You look at what he's doing as well, and he's taking on. Now, this is a big question, actually, whether this is genuinely possible for a coach to take on this anymore. But he's taken on a kind of almost a Ferguson-like general manager role. He's changing medical staff. He's changing the approach to all sorts of things. And there's a huge overhaul. And he's been given, if you like, the trust to do that. And bear in mind that this is Xavi coming into Barcelona under the presidency of Joan Laporta, was originally part of the electoral ticket of Victor Font, and he was going to arrive then as an overarching sporting director, effectively kind of a man in charge of everything. And it looks like that's kind of what's happening now. There's been a shift in these two games, but I think it's very early to say that in terms of how they tried to play. But obviously, trying to do it and being able to do it are not the same thing. Against Espanyol, in the end, they were very fortunate. It took a dodgy penalty, and Espanyol hit the post twice for them to win. Last night, I think it was slightly different, in that last night, the feeling at the end was they should have got caught out, by the way. There's an incredible miss from Benfica right at the end where he does this unbelievable bit of skill. I think he's a little bit lucky with the way the ball bounces to get past the goalkeeper, little dink over him, and then puts it wide. And Sebastia probably should have lost, but the feeling after it last night was about a team that need to score chances because they played much, much better than they had previously. And I suppose this takes us back to the conversation at the start. You know, it turns out goal scorers are quite useful. Now, and if on top of that, your goal scorer is Leo Messi, who not just scores goals, but does absolutely everything else. And you're looking at Barcelona this season, and one of the things that's really, really clear, even under Koeman, when they weren't playing well, and as I say, I'm reluctant to say that all of a sudden they're playing brilliantly with Xavi when it's only really two games. Even under Koeman, they were missing chances. And that was a big part of it. They would have got away with it if they'd taken some of those chances. And you think back over what Messi's done over the last 3 or 4 years, let's limit it to that, at a time when in theory, because of his age, he wasn't what he once was. And just the amount of goals that were, just because his technique is so superior to everyone else's. And yeah, you do sort of come back to that and think, a goal score wouldn't be a bad thing. And I suppose the other example, you mentioned Ronaldo and Messi. Last year, Atletico won the league on the basis of Luis Suarez standing there and sticking the ball in the net. And a lot of the time, us going, well, what else does he do? Not very much, but he stands there and he sticks the ball in the net.
Barry, we should talk about a bit more about that miss, because Seferovic, it was absolutely sensational. And like this kind of weird, you know, how were they 2-on-1? Like just every part of that bit of the game was hilarious.
Seferovic belting upfield on the counter. I didn't get the name of his teammate who was on the ball. Played perfect pass into his path. He dinked it over the keeper. Took a little knock off the keeper's shoulder, I think. But dropped nicely for him, and he slots it wide, the wrong side of the upright. An absolutely awful miss. The manager was on his, dropped to his knees and then buried his face in the grass on the sideline. He just could not believe it. And I mean, these are the margins, because if that had gone in, Barcelona are not going through to the knockout stages.
They're probably not anyway, in fairness.
They have to beat Bayern. If we're working on the assumption that Benfica will beat Dynamo Kiev, they might not. But the only thing is, Bayern are already through. They may not be that fussed. But even an unfussed Bayern Munich could well beat Barcelona.
Maybe what's happening here is that Harry Seferovic is keeping Benfica's Europa League hopes alive. He's gone rogue. He's like 4D chess. He just figures we have a much better chance in the Europa League, so I've got to take some responsibility here. I cannot square it because my teammate might put it in the goal, and that is absolutely not what we need right now. We need to get into that Europa League.
Wouldn't you love it if Benfica did win the Europa League, and at the end of the final, Harris stood up and said, I think you should all be thanking me for this. My grand master plan that none of you could see. This is what I did for you, lads. Rather than a limp exit in the next round of the Champions League against someone clearly better than us, I put us in a competition we could actually win. I reckon that's what Unai Emery's doing as well, obviously, if he had it out. Unai Emery's saying, listen, don't beat this lot. Come on, we'd much rather play the competition we can win.
We should mention Otamendi had a brilliant game and scored that disallowed goal because the corner went out of play and came back in and he smashed one in off the bar, which bounced down and hit the net. It was brilliant. Let's move on to Bayern Munich. They're winning Kiev. Orange ball, snow swept to the sidelines. Julian Nagelsmann's winter coat, lovely. Lewandowski overhead kick, 5.6 on the Sinclair Spectrum if you're interested. It was lovely. It wasn't a brilliant game, Lars. But the interesting thing about this is the number of Bayern players that were missing.
Yeah. Bayern's bench here was a bit odd. I mean, you wouldn't really think they had a problem from the first team. I mean, they were able to put out a very strong 11. Probably, to be honest, a stronger 11 than they would have wanted. I think they might have normally rotated a bit more. But some of the players who would have been rotated in were not available. They only had four outfield players on the bench and two goalkeepers on the bench, which I mean, I guess that was just like, maybe the third goalkeeper just wanted to go on a little trip abroad. You know, it's been a long period with the COVID. He maybe hadn't gotten out much. Maybe they needed him for the card games on the plane. I don't know. But they had two goalkeepers and four outfielders on the bench. Actually used all of the outfielders. So if you'd gotten an injury right before the end, you would have had to get one of the goalkeepers on, which I think we could all it's a real shame that that didn't happen. What's going on at Bayern is that they have five players who are having to quarantine because they've come into contact with, they've had a close contact who's tested positive, someone who works at the club. Now, the problem here is that if they had just gotten vaccinated, they wouldn't have had to quarantine. So currently, Bayern are five players down simply because players have decided not to quarantine. They haven't caught COVID, not to get vaccinated. They haven't caught COVID, they just didn't want to get vaccinated, and because of that, they now have to miss games. And you can imagine Bayern being not massively pleased by this. Bayern are apparently not going to pay them for the period of time they're not available, which is something that that the laws in Germany allow them to do, because this is a voluntary thing on the players' part, you know. And it is, as we say with the vaccination stuff, it is an individual decision, but the thing about individual decisions is they don't, you know, absolve you from the consequences of that individual decision. And in this case, the consequences is that they're not available for games where they absolutely should have been able to play. And it's obviously an issue for Bayern. Now, I should say that according to a report in Kicker last night, Serge Gnabry and Jamal Musiala have now received their first vaccination dose.
All right, that'll do for part one. Part two, we'll begin with Group G, and then Sid, you can go home. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. There's a live show on Tuesday, November the 30th, a Christmas special, Barry. Me, you, Lars, Wilson, sell it to the people.
I'm incredibly excited. Sorry, was that me?
I did ask Barry, but he just sat there in silence. So, you know.
No, fine. I thought that too. Someone needs to step in. Someone needs to say something here.
Barry, sell it to the people.
Um, I'd kind of forgotten about it, to be honest.
We at theguardian.com/guardianlive, there is a halftime spectacular which involves the producer going to do some filming tomorrow. I can't say any more than that, but it is tremendously exciting and also faintly ridiculous. You'll really enjoy it. Let's briefly discuss Group G. Sid, you can go after that. The group that no one's paid any attention to.
No, it's true. Not even in Spain.
Yeah, but might end up being the most exciting. Lille top, 8 points from five. Salzburg have 7 from 5. Sevilla 6 from 5. And Wolfsburg 5 from 5. So they can all go through. Sevilla won 2-0 against Wolfsburg. Lille beat Salzburg 1-0. Talk to me about the Sevilla win, Sid.
A kind of performance that we've seen a lot of Sevilla this year play games where they've been fundamentally better than the other side, where they've been strong, where there's been a sense of, you know, this is a good team somewhere in their way to get out. But there's something kind of not quite there, something missing. They're not quite as good as you think they should be. And in the Champions League, that's translated into actually pretty poor results. In La Liga, largely results have been pretty good without necessarily being sparkling. And this was more like the La Liga performances. So this is a win. It's a win where they are, I think, the better side and you know, significantly the better side. You're talking about a team that racks up kind of 10 or 15 shots. But that it takes till the very, very end to complete it. I look at Sevilla and I feel like this is a team that, if they get into the Europa League, could well win it. And actually, if they get through in the Champions League and it becomes head-to-head games, I wouldn't rule them out going for a couple of rounds, going for a couple more rounds and maybe being very strong against a good team. There is a solidity about them that isn't matched by their ability to score goals. Which seems to be a recurring thing today, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, Jonathan David scored Lille's goal. Inter and Liverpool both interested. Last part of the Canadian revolution, isn't he?
Yeah. I mean what can you say? Really exciting times for the Canadians with obviously Alphonso Davies, but also Jonathan David, who's really, I mean, they actually paid quite a bit of money for him, Jonathan David, because he was kind of known as one of these very talented young players around Europe, and he took a little while to settle, but he's really been on fire this season. He's got, let me just double check this, he's got 10 goals in 11 starts in Liga. I thought it was something like that. Scored twice against Monaco at the weekend, and is one of those players who, I mean, no disrespect, well, maybe some disrespect to Lille, will not stay there for a very, very long time. Like, he'll be signed for a lot of money by a bigger club in the summer, probably.
Sid, you may leave.
Thank you very much. Adios. Cheerio, everyone.
Thanks for coming on. Sid Lowe, out in Spain. Off to go home or go somewhere else. He's always on the move, is Sid.
He's looking very tidy this morning, I have to say, for listeners. He's ready for some kind of meeting. Yeah, all business.
Business Sid. Let's do Group H then. With apologies to Chelsea fans, but wanted to cover all the Spanish teams while Sid was there. Chelsea beating Juventus 4-0. And Barry, they were brilliant, weren't they?
Look, I don't watch a huge amount of Italian football because I just don't have time, but I was surprised by the going over Juventus got from Chelsea. It was 4-0, it could have been more, and the thing everyone's talking about from this game, I suppose, is the number of academy graduates that are in Chelsea's first team. Trevor Chalobah, Reece James, Callum Hudson-Odoi, Mason Mount, Ruben Loftus-Cheek, I think that's 5, is it? So I think their academy used to be seen as somewhere where players were farmed out on loan. You got loan fees, then they were sold on. A lot of them probably didn't really expect to get a chance or an opportunity in the first team. But Thomas Tuchel has come in, and admittedly Frank Lampard gave a few of these guys opportunities as well. But he has shown that there is a route through to the first team, and they had 5 in the team last night. There are other young academy players out on loan doing well at other clubs. Conor Gallagher is one that springs immediately to mind. And I think you look at how good Chelsea are and the fact that Thomas Tuchel has been there less than a year, it just shows how quickly things can change in football. And I think it's something Manchester United fans can take heart from, definitely, that if they get the right man in, things could change at Old Trafford very quickly.
Lars, which goal did you like better? Reece James' pure whack of a ball or the third goal, which was a beautiful move finished off by Callum Hudson-Odoi?
I'm very torn, but I think as much as I admired Reece James's technique, not just hitting the ball, but also the chest control was just perfect and just put the ball exactly where it needed to be. It was is one to study for aspiring young footballers and all those things we always say. The third one, the way they just sort of knitted their way through what has, you know, supposedly the great Juventus defense, you know, what we always consider to be like one of the best defensive teams around. And they just sort of tippy-tapped their way through them inside the box. It was incredible. I think I'm going to go with number three. I mean, it was quite something. And obviously, I think that was probably the most damning goal from a Juventus point of view, even though Cuadrado didn't exactly do brilliantly for the fourth one either. Like, no, not a great day at the office for Juventus defenders.
Yes, Nicky, let's have the Juventus Inquisition. What's happening?
Yeah, well, I mean, to start off with, Juventus don't have a great defence anymore. I mean, they've conceded 15 goals in Serie A this season. They haven't got a great anything anymore in it. I think what's striking, actually, is the first game against Chelsea in this group, I did it with you on Stan Sports, Max, and I frankly, watching that game was astonished. I thought Juventus were in trouble then, because Juventus weren't playing well domestically then either. And they came up with this very sort of blast from the past, just sort of draw back and be very solid and then play smart counter-attacking football. And you thought, oh gosh, in that moment, maybe Max Allegri is starting to find some of that magic. He's starting to find those old secrets that he always used to have to get the best out of this team, and especially in Europe, actually, because, of course, that was where he took big steps forward that Antonio Conte never did with Juventus. But since then, there's been no real progress. There's been huge problems scoring goals, for a start. I mean, it was telling at the weekend, they beat Lazio with two goals, both from penalties from Leonardo Bonucci, and afterwards it was like, oh, look how amazing Bonucci is. He's joined top scorer on your team. You think that's because no one else on the team scored more than three goals. He scored three goals this season, and that's enough to make you join top scorer at Juventus. But I think the difference between the two games, really, when you look at it, it's all the players that Barry mentioned. You know, Reece James, Callum Hudson-Odoi, but neither of those started the first leg. Ben Chilwell also didn't start at left back in the first meeting. All this youth that Chelsea put into the team, it felt like Juventus had no comeback to it. Like, this Juventus team is so stale. And it's not just an age thing, because it's not all the way through like a horribly old team. But this Juventus team is so stagnant, has completely got lost along the way the last few seasons, has a horrible mess of a squad, honestly. I mean, there's some really good footballers still in that squad, but it's so badly put together. There's no cohesion in the team building. And yeah, that I guess the purposefulness of youth, the directness of youth, just overwhelmed them at Stamford Bridge.
They played basically four central midfielders, no? I mean, but very attacking fullbacks. So I guess maybe the plan was like overlap-tastic. I don't know. It was odd.
Yeah, I mean, I think the four central midfield thing jumped off for everybody. Like, that was immediately picked up in Italy. Like, what the hell's he doing? And, you know, Max Allegri has styled himself over the years as, I'm not like your other managers who spend hours and hours poring over the tactics and rewatching the videos. I don't like to be one of these masochists who's at the training ground until midnight and back there at 5 a.m. I'm someone who goes on my feelings. I'm someone who trusts my instincts. And, you know, when it gets it right, people are like, oh, how amazing. But when your instinct is stick four central midfielders on and you get walloped 4-0, people tend to look at you differently.
Sorry, do you think you just woke up in bed this morning? You're just, today I'm feeling all midfielders all the time. No wingers at all. Let's just stuck them all in there.
The counterpoint is, again, this team building issue, which is not his fault. This is something that's been going on for years. And the Juventus signing, so the Ronaldo signing even is part of it. Ronaldo, as we can sort of say with more distance, clearly he wasn't the issue there. But I think what he represents was a team building policy for years. And maybe a start when Marotta was still there, but I think it got much worse after Beppe Marotta left the club as sort of the football CEO. This recruitment policy of just, we're just going to sign players who we sort of see are available either on a free or at what we think is a good price, and then we'll work out what to do with them later. It's like, you know, it's like when whichever family member it is in your family goes to the shop with a grocery list, and instead of coming back with the things in the grocery list, they've come back with, you know, 10 items they weren't supposed to get, except in this case, they aren't even like grocery items you don't want. It's like they've come back with 10 mobile phones, the expensive contracts. They got on a free signing on bonus for their phone, but now they've got to pay the bloody bill for them.
So basically, you're saying Juventus' squad is like the middle aisle at Lidl.
a little bit, yeah.
It's definitely not something we've ever said about Juventus before. So that's we're breaking new ground here. This is good.
Brendan says, I'm fairly certain that Timo Werner's missed a very similar chance at least 26 times in his Chelsea career so far. Is he now in the zone? Is this the start of the bucket loads, Max? Yeah, I believe it. Anyway, also in this group, Malmo Zenit. Malmo scored a goal in the Champions League, Lars.
I'm excited for them. But no, I'm cross about this, honestly, because I often come on this pod and sort of either like excuse or explain what referees were doing. There's no excusing or explaining the penalty that Zenith were given an extra time here. It's an absolute nonsense of a decision. And when it's an extra time of a game that Malmo are winning, it would have mattered an awful lot to them to get a win in the Champions League. Obviously, because winning is fun, but also just because of the prize money. Like, there is a difference financially between winning a game and not winning a game. And the difference is maybe not big enough to be a big deal for a big club like Juventus or Chelsea or whatever. But for Malmo, it's a few extra million that does go a long way. And basically, I had to have that result, taken away by the referee. This is a complete nonsense decision. It's not even remotely close to a penalty. So when you can watch it at the VAR as well, it's embarrassment. So I'm quite cross about this, honestly.
All right, that'll do for part two. Back in a tick. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Some breaking news, literally just happened in the last couple of seconds. You will have probably found out by now and digested it a bit more than we have, but Karim Benzema, France and Real Madrid striker, has been found guilty of conspiring to blackmail Mathieu Valbuena with a sex tape. The judge handed Benzema a one-year suspended jail term, ordered him to pay a €75,000, that is £63,000 fine. Philippe is on tomorrow. We will cover this in much more detail then. A story that, Lars, you pointed out to me this morning. These two Norwegian journalists arrested in Qatar. Yeah, Halvor Ekeland and Lokman Gorbani, working for the Norwegian Broadcasting Corporation, NRK, were arrested by Qatari authorities as they were leaving the country.
Yeah, so this is, in a way, this is related to the case of Abdullah Ibais, which Wilson mentioned on the pod recently. Abdullah Ibais is a former employee of Qatar's organizing committee who took a stand on workers' rights internally first and was then subjected to a criminal investigation on charges that he claims are trumped up. He then went public with his allegations, which were, you can read them on the OSIMAR website, but it's basically about Qatar not really doing enough for the migrant workers. And he was going to speak to a pair of journalists from the Norwegian state broadcaster, but was detained just before that happened. And even though his criminal case was still being appealed, he's been imprisoned and has gone on hunger strike since. Now, the journalists he were meant to speak to were then arbitrarily detained on Sunday night after having done a report on the welfare of migrant workers. They were detained seemingly with no legal basis at all, held for about 30 hours, had all their equipment confiscated. They were then released and sent back to Norway. There's a lot to like digest, but it's most of all, my first thought is this is incredibly embarrassing for the Norwegian FA, because earlier this year we had a huge debate in Norway on whether to boycott or not, and the Norwegian FA worked really hard to convince various member clubs that conditions in Qatar were improving, that Qatar is a good faith actor here who you can engage with and have dialogue with, which is clearly not the case. There was certainly no suggestion of that at all. The recent Amnesty International report suggests that if changes have been made, they're actually not having the desired impact on the ground. And Qatar detaining and bullying journalists for trying to report conditions on the ground says everything you need to know about how seriously they take this sort of stuff.
Now, there is a statement attributable to the Government Communications Office of the State of Qatar. It says, An NRK crew were taken into custody in the early hours of the 22nd of November for trespassing on private property and filming without a permit. The authorities arrested the crew in their hotel after responding to a complaint made by the owner of the private property on which the crew had illegally accessed. The crew were released without charge early on the 23rd of November after completing the necessary legal procedures. The Norwegian embassy and NRK executives were updated on the situation as it progressed. As in almost every country, trespassing is against Qatari law, which the crew members were fully aware of before entering the property. The crew were given access to film wherever they wanted in Qatar. Qatar's track record on media freedom speaks for itself. Qatar welcomes hundreds of international journalists and NGOs every year to report freely in the country. No journalist has ever been detained when Qatar's laws have been respected.
Yeah, we have had in recent months a lot of Newcastle fans trying to gotcha us by saying, well, will you be supporting or will you be covering the World Cup in Qatar as their response to our criticism of their new owners? And yes, we will be covering the World Cup in Qatar, and this is why.
I think so. And again, Philippe is on tomorrow, so he wanted to go into detail on this. It's worth reading the Josimar piece as well. We're also discussing exactly how we should cover this during the World Cup as well. You know, we're obviously, The Guardian's been doing some really good pieces sort of a year ahead of the tournament. And, you know, we'll be doing a number of specials next year, and then how we cover it during the World Cup as well. You know, we don't just want to do kind of, oh, here's one special, things are bad, and then sort of wash our hands of it and just talk about football. But we're working out the best way to do that. We send our best wishes to John Fleck, the Sheffield United midfielder. He's conscious in hospital after collapsing during their win at Reading. He was taken off after receiving lengthy treatment on the pitch early in the second half. The game stopped for nearly 10 minutes. Slavizar Jokanović, the manager, told BBC Radio Sheffield he's conscious in the hospital in good health. He'll be okay. A happy story from Stockport. Connor Jennings, the Stockport County forward, was diagnosed with a low-grade chondroid sarcoma in March, a rare form of cancer. An MRI scan located a tumour within his upper arm. He's been receiving treatment, working his way back to fitness. Last week, he was given the all-clear to resume playing. On Tuesday, he made his first appearance since the diagnosis from the bench in Stockport's Conference Premier win against Kings Lynn and scored in the 91st minute. So it's great news. Gareth Southgate has signed a new contract to keep him in the role until December 2024. It remains an incredible privilege to lead this team. We have a great opportunity in front of us, he said. Barry.
Well, it's no surprise, but it seems to have united fans of countries all over Europe. Fans who want England to win things are happy with this, and fans who don't want England to win things are also happy. So I think it's a good move for everyone, no matter what country you support.
You can't knock him. I mean, he's semi-final and a final. We'll get there, Barry.
Both of which you lost and both of which you should have won.
Oh, there we go. We'll end up getting to the World Cup final in Qatar, and by then we won't be covering it. So I won't even know. We'll win the World Cup and I won't have known. A couple of Italian questions. Nicky Giacomo says, does Nicky think Bonucci should start taking Italy's penalties instead of Jorginho after coolly netting two spot kicks over Lazio at the weekend? What is the general vibe about Italy possibly missing a second World Cup in a row?
Yeah, well, I mean, to answer the question, yes. I think lots of Italians watched Bonucci score two penalties and thought to themselves, God, why didn't he take, especially the last one against Switzerland? Because by that point, you'd already had Jorginho miss his previous two. And I think knowing that he'd missed the last one against Sommer, thinking about his confidence, Bonucci's one of those players who's just, you know, he's got that, not always justified, although he's obviously a brilliant defender, a brilliant footballer, and has been for a very long time, but he still makes mistakes. But he's got that absolute sort of arrogance about himself where you think, yeah, you back him to go take a penalty because he's just not going to doubt himself while he's up there. What's the vibe about Italy? It's not quite despair yet, because of course there is still the playoff, and I think there's also a very different feeling, even still, even after that terrible end to qualifying. It was terrible the last few games. There's still a different feeling about this team because, look, they won the Euros, because Mancini is trying to play positive, propositive football. Whereas the last time Italy missed out in the playoffs, it was Giampiero Ventura, who everyone hated and who was playing terrible football and who wouldn't bring his one good attacking footballer at the time, Lorenzo Insigne, off the bench. So there's still sort of some positive feeling around the team, but there is also a very great degree now of here we go again anxiety. And the fact that I didn't even realise until it was pointed out to me, and this is crazy by the way, because I was at Italy's last game in a World Cup. I was at the game against Uruguay where they lost. But the last time Italy played a knockout game at a World Cup, the last time Italy played an actual knockout game, was the 2006 World Cup final.
Wow.
And that's bonkers. That
that's a long time, isn't it?
When you think about it, 2010 didn't get out of the group, 2014 didn't get out of the group, 2018 weren't there. It's crazy to think that Italy weren't at a knockout game at a World Cup final since 2006. So yes, people are anxious.
And more importantly, I was very sad yesterday when Cambridge United were 2-0 up against Wigan. And then within 2 minutes, in the 84th and 86th minute or something, it was 2-2. And I was watching it next to a Wigan fan. And the whole thing was just a thoroughly disappointing 3 minutes and made me question why I like football at all. But still, it's a good point and I'd have taken it before the game. Robert says, can Lars give us an update on the MLS playoffs? Especially, well, he wanted to know about Jakub Gleznes for Philadelphia Union, which, I mean, you can tell me about that, but I'm much more interested in Seattle Sounders 0, Real Salt Lake 0, Seattle 21 shots, 3 shots on target, 62% possession, Real Salt Lake total shots, 0. Shots on target, 0, 38% possession. Salt Lake go through on penalties. That is heaven, isn't it?
You've got to respect it. Knocking out a far superior team in every way by having no shots, not just in 90 minutes, but 120 minutes. No shots at all. Two hours of football, not a single shot, and you manage to go through. That is the magic of football. Well done, I guess, to Salt Lake City, and commiserations with Seattle, who, you know, I guess this is just what happens in football occasionally. I do want to mention Gleznes, because Jakob Gleznes, he's a Norwegian center half who isn't one of those sort of like technically amazing. Like he's a man's man.
You're describing all Norwegian center halves there.
Chris Iyer is pretty tidy on the ball, but yeah, I know what you're saying. But he has this thing about he scores a couple of times a year. He will absolutely wallop one in from about 57 yards, and he did this again against New York. An extraordinary hit. He's a center half who usually just goes about his business, but occasionally will score a banger, and he did that in extra time against New York Red Bulls and sent Philadelphia through.
Dead Deer says, we've got a new badge and the canary's tail is too short. Send help. Tom says, Norwich have decided to update their badge. Can anything stop the contagious virus of minimalist badges? Will we soon see a liver bird made out of squares or a Puma Third Kit inspired no badge badge? What are the panel's favourite club badges? The Norwich City badge, are they... It's been 50 years, I think, since they changed the badge. And I read quite... I don't know if anyone else read that. I sent a link around. I don't know if anyone else had the time to read norwichat50.co.uk or whatever it was. But they described it quite well, that the canary was a bit off-centre, the ball wasn't in the middle, and then the lion that I'd never seen before on the Norwich City crest was sort of badly drawn or embroidered. So it was really hard to make sort of digital images of the Norwich City badge. So they've brought it into the modern era. And the explanation was, it certainly justified it to me. I have no hugely strong feelings about badges, but it's interesting when they showed a little graph or a sort of timeline of all the Premier League badges, and every other Premier League club has changed their badge sort of quite a few times, and certainly really recently. I never seem to notice. But, you know, if you are upset about the badge, I feel sorry for you. Just keep wearing an old kit, I would suggest. Norman says, following on from today's pod, I also had a dream involving Barry Glendening. I dreamt he was plucked from the audience to replace Ben Otterwell in Gomez at the last minute. Did a good job too. So well done, Barry. You're now the lead singer of Gomez. Do you know any Gomez songs?
No.
Okay, there we are. Whipping Piccadilly, I believe, is there. It's quite a good. I enjoyed that song. Oh, I think its references are not suitable for someone as square as me, I think, but I'm not an expert. Should we finish on a really nice email, which is quite a long one, but it is nice. And we haven't done one of these for a while.
Is this self-indulgence corner, Max?
Yeah, it, you know what? It is self-indulgence corner. But we get so many of these that I sometimes think maybe we should be slightly self-indulgent. You know, it's too late to vote for us for an award. Now, that's too, that ship has sailed. If you listen to this and it, you know, it chimes with you, it's too late to actually really thank us in a way we would want. Not that we care, of course, about winning awards. This is from Adam, who says, "Hi, all. I never thought I'd write into the pod from any other format besides Twitter, but I thought right now with the holiday season approaching, it seemed an apt time to write in, whether or not my letter's actually shared during a recording. Thanksgiving is this Thursday in the US. While it's a holiday with terrible connotations that we don't address enough here in the States, in recent years, I've gone through some substantial life changes. It's provided a healthy, albeit hard, opportunity to reflect on the people and circumstances I'm incredibly grateful for. Back in September, a man from Australia wrote in about how alone he often felt over the course of the pandemic and how when he listened to the pod, it felt like he was hanging out with friends. That moment really struck a chord with me and it did make me cry. For context, my father passed away suddenly in the summer of 2019, right before my senior year of college. And as many people know, grief is complicated, confusing, and downright awful. But in a weird way, it sometimes makes you reckon with your own life and what you value most. Although I didn't watch much soccer until I was 10 or 11, I've been playing since I was five. I've loved every minute of it. My dad and I started watching La Liga and the Premier League in the late 2000s. Messi was a big hook. And I then think I watched almost every game I could with the time difference of the 2010 World Cup. Safe to say I was hooked. My dad was involved in almost every major soccer experience in my life. My first professional game, a Brazil-Ghana friendly at Craven Cottage, featuring an aging Ronaldinho and a young spiky-haired Neymar. My first Chelsea game and a road trip to Canada for the 2015 Women's World Cup. I even remember calling him after we separately watched La Remontada live while I was off at college. So when I discovered Football Weekly in the spring of 2019, I was really excited to share the podcast with him because besides myself, he didn't have too many people to enjoy and discuss football with. Unfortunately, he passed away before I ever had the chance to share it with him. There were many times, especially in the first year after he passed, where I felt alone because nobody could understand what I was going through. But at the same time, I still didn't want to be alone. And more often than not, this podcast really helped me through those dark moments. As a Jewish kid who grew up in rural Iowa, which you may guess does not have many Jewish people, the holiday season in the US has always been a conflicting and complicated time for me. And yet over the past couple of years since my dad's death, taking the time to reflect on the people and experiences I value the most in life has made this time of year much easier. So with all that in mind, I want to thank you for continuing to do what you do and challenging yourselves, as well as us listeners, to grow and learn as this sport that we love continues to grow and develop. It's been an absolute joy to listen to this pod over the past couple of years. Thank you for all the laughs, cries, and thoughtful discussions. I'm incredibly grateful for the work that everyone involved with this podcast does. Whether or not this is shared on the recording, I hope some of you get to see this because the work you do has meant a lot to me, and I'm sure many others. Happy Hanukkah, Merry Christmas, and I'll see y'all, he says, on Tuesday at the live show. Happy holidays, Adam. P.S. What are the panelists' favourite type of pie? Which... which is a really great way, which is a really fantastic way to end a really emotional and sort of lovely journey through, you know, what this podcast means to you. And we really appreciate it. Chicken and mushroom, I would say. Barry?
I would normally say steak and ale, but considering the sort of holiday theme, I'll go mince pie.
Okay. Lars?
You know what? I like the sort of crossover, the chicken balti pie. I think it's very nice.
Okay. And Nikki?
I think the true one is probably what Bear said, which is mince. But since I'm actually going to a Thanksgiving party the next few days with my friend Tracy, who makes amazing pies. Last year, even though we were locked down, she sent everyone slices of pie she'd made for Thanksgiving. And her pecan pie is what I'm looking forward to very much. So I'm going to say pecan pie.
Perfect. Well, thank you, Adam. Thank you, everybody. Thank you, Barry.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Lars.
Thank you, Max.
Thank you, Nikki.
Thanks.
We'll be back probably with no self-indulgent emails tomorrow.
This is The Guardian.